womanhood and the family had always craved more than anything else in the world had been far worse. I would usually describe myself as an emotional train crash. I cry at the most pathetic adverts on the TV. But a strange calm came over me now. I felt a surge of strength, a new purpose and meaning flow through me. The survival instinct was flooding through my veins. I was being reborn. I knew what I had to do, and it didn't involve crying, taking a passive role, or relying solely on the medical profession. I had been let down too often. I'd had such faith in the NHS and the medical system as a physiotherapist, and been so sure I'd be looked after and put back together. It was a painful and bruising lesson to discover just how ineffective it could be at times. In the end, it had come as a depressing realization that cancer treatments were not nearly as effective as they make out in the mainstream press. The game changers rarely were. The system was inherently flawed, set up to benefit the pharmaceutical industry rather than the patient. Patients were routinely let down by a lack of proactive treatment. Prevention did not seem to exist. Rather, it was a matter of waiting for the cancer to come back, for the axe to fall, before they got off their backsides to treat you with their latest array of toxic chemicals. The doctor asked what my last squamous cell marker had been. My what? He said I could have had blood markers that might have shown up any progression, but I had never been offered one. Ever. Why? It was so simple and non-invasive. Why had no one ever suggested them? Where was the proactive approach in all of this so-called care? When the doctor left us alone to work out what we wanted to do, I put my arms around Andrew, and we just hugged in silence for several minutes. I had no clothes or toothbrush with me for an overnight stay. Come on, you'd better run home and get my things, I said.
I don't want to leave you, he said. I can't go back home tonight while you're all alone after what he's told you. It's not right. I want to stay with you.
Look, I really don't feel that bad. I'm sure they're just being ridiculously cautious about the whole bursting blood vessel thing, I said, trying to sound reassuring. We can get through this. Let's take it one day at a time. I was quite surprised I was even able to speak without sounding panicked. An inner strength had emerged that I had no idea existed. I'd never felt stronger. I felt I was rising up from the ashes. I could do this. I was sure of it. I was being faced with the greatest challenge of my life, and I would face it full on, with bravery. Time to man up, as I told Andrew earlier. With this terminal diagnosis, suddenly everything came into focus. Despite all the grief that had overcome me before, I realized I could not waste another ounce of energy on that destructive emotion. I had to channel everything into survival. Dying was not an option. It might seem an obvious thing to say, but I've met many patients who accept their fate with little resistance, almost with a shrug of acceptance. Well, I've had a good life, they say, conceding that it's over without even considering a fight. That somehow bad luck had dealt its card and there was little they could do. No, I had too much living left. I was still only 35, and I resolved to investigate everything I possibly could. There was said to be no cure, but I was sure the answer had to be out there, perhaps buried in old papers or an overlooked study. I would somehow find it. I refused to see myself as a wounded soldier limping to my untimely demise. I was a fighter, back on the front line. Although I was carrying many deep scars physically, mentally, and emotionally, they were not enough to stop me from picking myself up and walking back into the fray. Was I ready? Bring it on.
Chapter 4. Collaborators, not dictators. It took a lot of persuading to get Andrew to leave me at the hospital that night. To be honest,
I nearly refused to stay. The warmth and comfort of my own bed, the normality of being at home, the reassurance of waking up next to him was the only thing I wanted at that moment. But the situation was apparently life-threatening. So reluctantly, Andrew drove home, gathered up some clothes for me, and sped back to the hospital to meet me on the ward. It was after visiting hours, but the staff showed some compassion and allowed him to stay for an hour. I had a side room to myself, which was a relief. The last thing I wanted was the hurly-burly of a ward. I needed space to think. I was still coughing up the blood, a nasty reminder of what was going on inside. Otherwise, physically, I didn't feel that bad. Mentally, I was terrified, of course. What if they were right and I burst a major vessel in the middle of the night and needed emergency life-saving surgery? Andrew was equally terrified, but we chose to think about other things, practical stuff, organizing ourselves to deal with this enormous change in our circumstances. Our wedding had been planned for 3 months' time. The church, the reception, everything was booked and invitations had been sent out. I realized with dismay that there was a good chance I was going to be given chemotherapy yet again. Not only would I feel sick, I would be bald, which, let's face it, is not the best look for a bride. It wouldn't be the wedding I had always dreamed of, looking gorgeous, healthy, and radiant. Bugger this cancer. It had ruined my chance of a family, and now it was ruining my wedding, too. We'd have to postpone. We would wait until we knew just how far the cancer had spread before breaking any news to anyone, except for my sister Susie, a doctor. I would talk to her. She'd been amazing at helping me through the first time, although I knew I'd relied on her too much and hadn't done enough research for myself. She knew very little about alternative treatments, and I knew that orthodox medicine, this time, would not be enough to save me. At 11 o'clock that night, the staff nurse came in and said she really was sorry, but she couldn't allow Andrew to stay any longer. We had a long hug. It was so hard to let go. I promise I'll be fine. I have a phone. I'll text you first thing tomorrow. He struggled to leave, lingering at the door. After the doctors had put the fear of my imminent death in his head, he wasn't sure if this was the last time he would see me. Go on. Go home. I'm absolutely fine. He slowly turned into the corridor, blowing me a final kiss. I was left alone with my thoughts. Back at home, Andrew got straight onto the internet and looked up the statistics and my chances of survival. In 1999, no one could source information at the click of a button on a mobile. For me, stuck on the ward that night, it was probably a good thing. But for Andrew, it was a different story. I don't think he got any sleep that night. Sitting there alone in my hospital room, 5 miles away from home with no depressing statistics to ponder, I was already starting to feel more upbeat. I decided I wanted to see the X-ray taken months earlier at the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I needed to know if the cancer had been present then, as I was deeply suspicious that it had been missed. From that, we could work out what the tumour doubling time was, how fast it was growing. I had learned quite a bit about cancer looking after my mother, but nowhere near enough. Why had I not known about the blood tests? Amazingly, I slept well. By the time the doctors crowded into my room first thing in the morning, I was smiling and cheerful. Honestly, there must have been 10 of them, all full of morbid fascination to see this 35-year-old with stage 4 cancer. I felt like a prize exhibit. I think they were more than a little surprised by my upbeat attitude. Perhaps they thought I hadn't quite grasped the gravity of the situation. Well, I was still alive, wasn't I? I hadn't bled to death during the night. That was a good start. They looked carefully at the X-ray and decided the major blood vessels were a sufficient distance from the tumour not to pose an immediate threat to my life. So I could go home, provided I came back later that day for more tests. Hooray! I wasted no time checking myself out of the Hammer House of Horror. I phoned Andrew, who immediately drove over to collect me. The relief of being back home was overwhelming. After cuddling my two gorgeous cats, I allowed myself to cry for the first time. Big sobs came from deep down as I buried my head in Andrew's arms. But as I cried, I knew I had to get to work. I didn't have time to feel sorry for myself. I needed to be in control. I too wanted to know what the statistics said. Andrew told me not to look, but I needed to know. What I saw shook me to the core. Everything the doctors did to me from this moment on could affect my chances of survival, and too many mistakes had been made already. This time, I was going to play a big part in my treatment choices, whether the doctors liked it or not. I had been too traumatized and depressed by my diagnosis the first time round to be able to do anything other than agree to suggestions and meekly and submissively take the first path offered. I had been too passive and too desperate to get rid of the cancer. This time, it was going to be different. It was my body they were treating. I was going to run the show, and the doctors were going to play important parts, but not the lead role. That part was mine, thank you. Many doctors are a little affronted by a patient armed with a long list of questions, particularly about alternative treatments. And if you dare mention diet, then expect a quick and scornful dismissal. Don't even think about bringing up the subject of nutrition or ketosis. It sounds too similar to ketoacidosis. Your doctor will immediately tell you to avoid it. Oncologists are, on the whole, in a league of their own, certain that they know what's best for you with a my way or the highway approach. Despite this mostly dogmatic attitude, instilled by years of training, I knew there were some super ones prepared to listen to the patient and respect their wishes. Good oncologists even acknowledge that patients can be their greatest teachers. But I have come across too many who are arrogant, who seem to enjoy belittling those in their care. This does nothing for the confidence of the ordinary patient, who is made to feel ignorant and stupid in the presence of their superior medical knowledge. All it does is feed the oncologist's ego. Attitudes are slowly changing, but even today I know a doctor whose coffee mug reads, "You are confusing your quick Google research with my 6-year medical degree," which he'll leave strategically on his desk before meeting the incurable hypochondriac. Social media and the internet has meant many patients now become experts in their own disease. There is no doubt that there are doctors who are highly skilled and knowledgeable, who understand their patients' diseases. They appreciate the interaction of drugs, and they are aware of the course of the cancer, the statistics, and the conventional options. They are there to help guide you through the medical minefield with its confusing terminology and hidden pitfalls. I have great respect for their knowledge. Despite this, it seemed to me that my oncologist was missing the bigger picture. I was going to have to become my own expert. I would need to learn all the medical terms if I was to understand the research, be treated as an equal, and have the doctors listen to me, rather than treat me as a patient with a lump that had to be shrunk. And I would have to learn fast. Time, the doctors reminded me, was not my friend. But I already had a great deal of medical knowledge. That was a bonus. And I had already learned much about cancer from researching for my mother. Terms such as angiogenesis and apoptosis were already familiar. I was never going to turn my back on conventional treatment completely, but there had to be other options to the surgery and chemotherapy. It seemed medical progress had made little headway for decades. To survive, I needed to take the treatment further than anyone had done before, to add things to my treatment, not only to address the genetic mutations, but the metabolic problems that went with it, an area that seemed to be ignored by the mainstream, despite Otto Warburg's research dating back to 1924. To beat it, I had to know my enemy. I had to discover its every little nuance, exploit its weak points, its Achilles' heels, and hit them all together. I would tackle it from every angle I could, whether with conventional drugs, supplements, or